rest. I wasn't too sure anymore if this was a good decision, but it was too late to worry now. I made sure I could see the first turning point before the stream by scraping away the mud between the trunk and the ground. I'd used the same tactic time and again in the jungle, where it was standard procedure to loop the track and put in an instant ambush on your own trail. If we were being followed, they would pass no more than 60 or 70 meters away and move half left away from us and into the dead ground. There they'd find the stream, and start trying to cast over the other side to pick up our scent or ground sign again. That would give us vital time in which to act. If I saw dogs while lying up, I'd just have to make a run for it. The heli passed overhead yet again, this time at speed, but we were well concealed. It could stay there all day if it wanted to. It wouldn't make any difference. Sarah was looking at me, waiting for an explanation. We wait until last light, and go back towards the road. I pointed uphill. That way. She wasn't enjoying this outing, but she cuddled into me. I was wedged against the trunk looking out. She was behind me, her body spooned against mine with her arms around my chest. I could feel her warmth. I tried hard not to think about how much I liked her depending on me. Continuing to look out, I tilted my head towards her. Concealment is our best weapon. It's going to be cold, and you'll think you're about to die, but you won't. As long as we keep close and keep each other warm, do you understand that? I felt her nodding. Then she squeezed herself a little more tightly against me. Even in these circumstances, I had to admit it felt good. There were three situations I'd hated all my life. Being wet, cold or hungry. Four if you included having to shit in the field. All our lives, even as children, those are the three things that most of us try to avoid. But here I was, doing it again. And I couldn't help feeling that, at 38, I should be seriously concentrating on getting a life. The one I had seemed to be going nowhere fast. As the minutes ticked by, my body started to cool, even with Sarah snuggling in behind me. And the ground itself seemed to become colder and soggier. I could feel her body warmth at the points where she was making contact with me, but the rest of me was freezing. Every time she fidgeted to get comfortable, I could feel the cold attack the newly exposed area. She fidgeted again and muttered, "Sorry, cramp," as she tried to stretch out her leg and tip up her feet in an effort to counter it. I kept stag, listening to the stream, the wind in the treetops, the rain dropping onto the leaves and debris on the forest floor. There was a murky, calf-high mist permeating the woods, which reminded me of stage smoke. That could work either for us or against us. It would give us some visual cover if we were forced to move, but it was also good for the dogs. As time passed without any hint of a follow-up, I started to feel better about our situation. I looked at my watch. 7:46. Only another 12 hours or so until last light. Doesn't time fly when you're enjoying yourself? At least the baby G surfer was keeping cheerful. Sarah had settled down and wanted to talk. "Nick?" "Not now." I needed time to think. I wanted to take a long, hard look at what she'd told me, and to think about all that had happened. Was she bluffing about the Netanyahu plot? How did they plan to kill him? How had she been planning to stop them? My head was full of questions, but no answers. Now wasn't the time to ask. Tactically, noise had to be kept to a minimum, and besides, I needed to keep my head clear for the task in hand. I had to get out of here alive, preferably with Sarah still alive too, for there was still another job to do. Chapter 21. An hour later, Sarah and I were chilled to the bone and shivering violently. I tried to combat the cold by tensing up all my muscles and then releasing them. That worked for a while, but I was soon shaking again. I didn't have a clue how Sarah was coping, and I didn't care now. My head was in hyper mode, trying to work out my options. Was she telling the truth? Should I call London if I got out of this? Should I get help from within the US? From Josh, maybe? No. He wouldn't be back from the UK yet. I heard a noise and hoped that I hadn't. Peering through the mud hole, I opened my jaw to improve my hearing. My heart sank. I turned my head to look at Sarah, who was just about to tell me that she'd heard the dogs too. The sounds were coming from the direction of our approach. I couldn't see them yet, but they would be on us. It was only a matter of time. My eyes and puckered lips told her to stay quiet. Then I moved my head back to the hole in the mud. Sarah put her mouth against my ear.
"Come on, let's go."
I whispered for her to shut the fuck up. They were coming over the brow of the rise. There was a gang of them. The first thing I noticed was the two big, snarling dogs on long leads, steam rising off their wet coats, their handler fighting to keep control. The good thing was that they were German shepherds. They weren't tracker dogs, but hard dogs, there to bridge the gap between us and the pursuers if we were spotted. The other good thing was that they didn't look quite so big with their coats wet against their skin. The pursuit consisted of a 6-man police team. One of them had a Springer Spaniel on a lead, its nose to the ground, loving the whole business. Apart from the tracker dog handler, none of them was dressed for the hunt. They were wearing just their normal brown waterproof jackets, and two of them were even in shoes, with mud splattered up their pressed brown and yellow striped trousers. They passed us, in a haze of dog noise and steam, as our tracks took them half left, away from us, and towards the stream. The moment they were in dead ground, I turned to Sarah. "Now we go." I squeezed under the trunk and immediately broke into a run in a line directly away from the river. Maybe my hide-until-dark plan hadn't been such a good idea after all. The only option now was to outrun the team. It was unlikely the dogs would tire, but they could only go as fast as their handlers, so I would just have to get them exhausted. The police had looked wet and hassled, and were breathing hard. Even in our shit state, we should be fitter than they were. I pushed on, looking for a point where we could hide a change in direction. It might not stop them, but it would slow them down. After close to 30 minutes of hard running through thick woodland, I had to stop and wait for Sarah to catch up. She was panting deeply, clouds of her breath fusing with the steam coming off her head. When we moved off again, I checked my watch. It was 10:39. We went for it for another solid hour. Sarah was lagging further and further behind, but I pushed the pace. I knew she would keep going. When we used to train together in Pakistan, she would never give up, even on a silly fun run. And then it was only her pride at stake. Now it was a bit more than that. We were in low ground, and I could see sky about 200 meters in front of us, through the tree trunks. I heard the sound of a car and then splashing on tarmac. I crawled up to the tree line. It wasn't a major road, just a single carriageway in each direction. And not particularly well kept, probably because it wasn't used that much. The sort of backwoods road that looked as if the tarmac had just been poured from the back of a slowly moving truck and left to get on with it. It might even be the same road as the last one. There was no way of telling. The rain wasn't firing down like a power shower anymore, just a constant drizzle. I still didn't have a clue where we were, but that didn't matter. You're never lost. You're only in a different place from the one you wanted, and at a different time. Sarah had crawled up next to me and was lying on her back. Her hair had clumped together so I could see the white skin of her skull. We looked as if we both had our personal steam machine strapped to us. I decided to turn right. It could have been left all right. It didn't really matter. And just follow the road. At some stage we'd find a vehicle, or at least discover where we were. Then work out what we were going to do. Ready? She looked up and gave a nod and a sniff, and we crawled backwards, deeper into the tree line. I got to my feet and she accepted my outstretched hand. I hauled her upright and we started running again, paralleling the road. After only a minute or two I heard a car. I got down and watched as it splashed through the potholes, lights on dipped, side windows misted up and the wipers on overtime. As soon as it had disappeared from view, we were up and running. The next vehicle was a truck loaded with logs. Its wheels sank into an enormous pothole and threw up a wall of water which fell just short of us. There seemed to be a vehicle of some description every 5 minutes or so. Most were going in our direction, which was a good sign. I didn't know why, but it felt that way. After another 2 kilometres or so, I began to see lights forward of us and on the opposite side of the road. As we got closer, I could see that it was a gas station come small general store with a tall neon sign saying, "Drive-through, open," in orange letters. It was a one-storey flat-roofed concrete building with 3 pumps on the forecourt, protected by a high tin canopy on a pair of steel pillars. The place had probably been state-of-the-art when it was built in the 60s or early 70s, but now the white paint was grey and peeling, and the whole fabric of the building was falling apart. I knew how it felt. There were windows on the 3 sides of the shop that I could see. Above, the ones at the front were large red raised letters telling me the place was called Happy Beverage and Grocery. Faded posters advertised coffee and corn dogs, Marlboro and Miller Lite. They were all the same, these sorts of places. Family run as opposed to franchised mini markets, and I knew exactly what this one would smell like inside. A mixture of stale cardboard and Kona coffee, fighting with the aroma of the corn dogs as they rotated in their glass oven. All rounded off, of course, with a good layer of cigarette smoke. The main sound effect would be the hum of fridges working overtime. Even the pumps outside were early 70s. This place was in decline, maybe years ago. When the road was first built, it was a major hotspot. But once the freeways had been laid to move the growing population of North Carolina, the traffic went elsewhere. Happy Beverage and Grocery looked like it was already history. I stopped just short of the drive-through sign on the other side of the road and got down. Sarah joined me, and I told her to wait where she was. I crawled forward. I'd been right. Now that I could see through the windows, my eyes hit on packets of everything from Oreos to Cheerios, and a line of glass-doored fridges, which were less than a quarter full of milk cartons and Coke cans. A large glass pot of coffee was stewing away on a hob, alongside a whole range of polystyrene cups, from 2 pints down to 1/2 pint, depending on how awake you wanted to be. If you wanted cream, it would be powdered, without a doubt. On her own, as far as I could see, and sitting down behind the counter, was a large woman in her mid-30s. I could only see her top half. She had peroxide blonde, big hair, which was probably kept that way with a can of lacquer a day. She must have been one of those southern women the radio program had been talking about. The T-shirt was probably her daughter's going by its tightness. I couldn't see her bottom half. But no doubt she'd be wearing leggings that were about 4 sizes too small. She was eating a corn dog and reading a magazine, and somehow managing to smoke at the same time. I crawled back to Sarah. "Can we take a vehicle?" she said. "Not yet. It doesn't look as if she has one." Beyond the shop was another tarmac road that met this one at a T-junction. The only thing that interested me was that, where you have junctions, you nearly always have signposts. We headed for the junction. The neon lights was reflecting off the rain-swept road and the hard standing of the pump area. I had to remind myself that it was still daytime. The sign said, drive-through, and I'd do just that, given half a chance. I started to envy the woman with big hair. She was sitting in there with a TV or radio on, and the heaters would be blasting away to keep the condensation off the windows. In fact, she was probably keeping so hot that she might need to knock back a Coke after the corn dog. I wondered how she'd keep the cigarette in her mouth. We passed the shop and carried on to the junction. I motioned for Sarah to wait, but she'd got her breath back, and with it, some of her old habits. She'd never liked being ordered around and not being part of the show. She came with me. I moved forward the last 10 meters and spotted a signpost, green tin on a tin stake. To my left, the way we had come wasn't signed. To my right was a place called Creedmoor, which was no good to me. I didn't know it from a hole in the ground. But I knew where Durham was. It was just west of the airport. Lots of people and traffic, somewhere we could get lost. The sign said that the road facing me was going that way. It passed the gas station at the junction on the left, went uphill for about half a mile, with muddy drainage ditches on each side, then disappeared to the right behind a line of tall firs. That was where I wanted to go once I'd lifted a vehicle, but before I did anything, I had to make sure the woman couldn't call for help. My eyes followed the phone lines from the building across the junction. They paralleled the road running from my left to right. I moved in the Creedmoor direction, about 20 meters beyond the junction, and crawled back up to the road, looked and listened. Absolute silence. I got to my feet, nodded at Sarah, and we sprinted across. Once back in the trees, I followed the phone lines until I found a pole about 5 meters short of the junction. I started taking my belt off and asked Sarah for hers. This time she didn't question me. She followed the line of my gaze as I studied the top of the pole. "Are you going up there?" "I want to cut the line to the gas station." "Are we going to rob it?" Sometimes she only had a nodding relationship with reality. I stopped pulling my belt off and looked at her. "Are you serious?" I wondered about what had happened to all those expensive years of university training. She had enough brain power to move a glass without even touching it, but sometimes she didn't seem to have even an 11-plus in common sense. "We're just going to get a car and get the fuck out of here," I said. "We have guests arriving. Remember?" I mimed a dog biting with my hand. I took her belt and buckled the two together to make one big loop. Hers was the American's heavy biker's belt with a Harley Davidson logo that said, "Live to ride, ride to live." I dropped the loop at the bottom of the pole, hooked my feet inside either end, gripped the pole with my hands and started to climb. I'd learned how to do this from a documentary on the South Pacific, when I'd seen blokes use similar devices to climb coconut trees. You slid your feet up as high as you could, keeping the strap taut, then pressed down until it gripped. It was then a matter of reaching up and gripping the pole with both hands, lifting your feet again and so on. That was the theory. The pole was so wet and slippery, however, that it took me several attempts to master it. At the end of the day, though, I was rather impressed with myself. If ever I was marooned in Polynesia, I wouldn't go hungry. I heard the hiss of tires and the drone of an engine getting closer. My heart missed a couple of beats while I wondered how I'd explain myself. Then both sounds changed direction and died as the car turned and headed towards Durham. It happened twice more. Each time I stopped and waited until the vehicle had gone. At least the treetops gave me some cover. I had just another couple of feet to go when I heard a fourth vehicle approaching, but this time from the direction of Durham. It was going slowly and coming close. I looked down for Sarah, but she was already moving away from the pole and into cover. The car drew up at what I guessed was the junction and stopped. I heard a door open and the sound of radio traffic. It had to be a police cruiser. I couldn't reach down for my weapon because it was taking all my strength and grip just to stop myself sliding back down the pole. I wondered about climbing up the last couple of feet so I could rest on a crossbar, but the way my luck was going, I'd probably fuck it up and come hurtling down like Fireman Sam and land on their heads. I heard a burst of laughter and looked down again. Sarah was nowhere to be seen, but a smoky bear hat was, covered in clear plastic, shaped so it kept the felt dry. It moved into the woods, above a dark brown raincoat that stuck out at the sides. State troopers have zips up the sides of their coats to enable them to draw their pistols easily, but this guy wasn't doing that. He was undoing his front zip. I saw his knees jerk as he released himself, then the sound of piss hitting the tree just a few feet below me. Steam rose in front of the hat. I didn't want to make the slightest sound. I didn't even want to swallow. My fingers were starting to lose their grip on the rain-slicked pole. I searched frantically for the trooper's mate. I couldn't see him. He must have stayed in the car, as you do when it's raining. I could see raindrops ricocheting off the garage roof, glistening in the light from the drive-through sign. The stream of urine against the tree subsided as he finished off. Then he let go a resounding fart. I started sliding. I pressed down hard on the belt with my feet and gripped the pole like a drowning man. The sounds below had stopped, and I watched him jigging up and down to shake off the drops. He packed himself away, checked his coat, and strode off. I heard the troopers joking to each other. The car door slammed, and then they drove off. I let out all the air I'd been holding in my lungs, inching myself further up the pole to increase my range of vision. The cruiser was finally driving into the gas station. Why the fuck didn't he go in there in the first place? Maybe he was trying to chat up the woman, and the last thing he wanted was for her to hear him farting away and stinking the place out. I reached the top and hooked my left arm around the cross spar. I took a few deep breaths to calm myself down, then looked for Sarah. She was emerging from the bush she'd been hiding in, and I wondered if she knew how lucky she'd been. It looked a very inviting bush, and she might easily have got drenched by old farty pants. I followed the telephone line to make sure it was the one to the gas station, reached down and retrieved the Leatherman from my pocket. Where these lines come into a pole, they get hooked up to take the tension from the line, and then there's a nice little loose bit which carries on through. I leaned out, squeezing hard with the rubber soles of my feet, got the pliers part of the Leatherman over the line, and snipped. Then it was just a case of sliding down the pole nice and slowly so I didn't land up with half a ton of splinters in my arms and legs. Sarah was straight in at me. "Give me a gun, Nick. What if he'd seen you?" It made sense, but I felt uneasy. Giving Sarah a weapon seemed to be a lot like giving Popeye spinach. On the other hand, if he'd spotted me, she could have done something about it. I still wasn't sure whether she would fuck me over, but decided she still needed me too much. I'd let her have it for now. I got Lance's semi-automatic 9mm Eastern Bloc thing out of my jacket and handed it over. She said a sincere, "Thanks," as she pushed back the top slide half an inch and checked to see if there was a round in the chamber. The cruiser was driving out to the gas station and coming back in our direction. We both got down and she used the time to put her belt back on. The blue and white passed us heading towards Creedmoor. Maybe they were helping to man a roadblock or something further up the road. I wanted her to stay where she was while I went back to the gas station to hijack a vehicle. She insisted on coming with me. "Listen," I said. "A man and a woman turning up at a gas station stealing a vehicle. Don't you think there's a bit of a chance they'd make a connection with the lake?"
"Nick, I'm coming with you. I'm not going to take the chance of us getting split up and this all going wrong. We're going to stay together."
She was right. Without realizing it, she had reminded me what I was here to do. If there was a drama with the police or whoever, and it was obvious I was about to lose control, I would have to kill her before they could get her. Not the ideal option. But at least she'd be dead. Looking at her with my not-happy-about-it face on, I gave in to her demand. "Fuck it. Come on, then." We finished doing up our belts, moved back up the road for more distance and crossed. We turned right and paralleled to a point where I could get a clear view of the pumps and the shop again. One car, a white Nissan Saloon, was already on the forecourt, but it was four up, with two couples in their mid-twenties. The driver had just started the engine and out he rolled. I heard a distinctive ding-ding as the tyres ran over a rubber tube sensor. He got to the road, stopped, turned his wipers and dipped lights on, laughing with the rest of them. Probably about the woman with the corn dog. Turned left and off they went. We lay there, waiting in the rain. During the next 10 minutes, two news vans with satellite dishes scuttled past along the road, headlights blazing, windscreen wipers working furiously on their way to get the story. Another car rolled onto the forecourt. It was a Toyota, full of a family. I was half up, ready to go for it, like a big cat watching the herd. The car was ideal. A normal family saloon. Dad got out and, avoiding the rain, ran straight into the shop. I saw him give Big Hair a few bills, then he came out again and filled up. I decided against. I was looking at the family, two kids in the back, window half steamed up, the kids beating each other up, the mother turning round and shouting at them. There were just too many people in the car. It would be a nightmare to drag two screaming kids from the car. Ding, ding. They took the Durham Road. Sarah looked over at me. "I thought we were in a hurry." Big Hair was walking across to the machine to get herself another bucket of coffee. She went and sat back by the till, next to the window, looking out, wistfully stirring her bucket with a spoon. I was right. It was packet creamer. Perhaps she dreamed that one day Clint Eastwood would drive onto her forecourt, come in to pay for gas, and bang. The bridges of Happy Beverage County. Until then, nice work if you can get it. A sign to the left of the shop entrance announced 24-hour video surveillance, together with the fact that they only carried $50 in the register and the rest was slipped into a night safe that the attendant didn't have access to. I turned to Sarah. "When we go to lift the wagon, I want you to get your T-shirt and pull it over your head, so you can only just see out of it." Ding, ding. Another vehicle drove in towards the pumps from our left. This time, it was a really old van, late 70s, early 80s, the sort of thing Mr. T and the A-team used to run around in, but a very tired grey. The windows were half steamed up, so I couldn't see how many were inside. But as soon as the driver opened the door, I knew this was the one. He was in his early 40s, and the important thing was that he got out and didn't take the ignition key with him, but just waved at the woman. He must be a local because he was trusted enough to fill up and pay afterwards. We got back into our big cat positions, and I studied our prey. He was wearing a pair of green overalls that had seen better days, with oil stains and rips in the knees. His baseball cap should have been white, but needed burning more than bleaching now. He was skinny, and of average height, with about 3 days' stubble and 4 years' worth of wet or very greasy hair over his shoulders. The tank was full. The filler cap went back on. I whispered, "You ready?" She nodded. He turned and, with his hands working their way into his overalls for money, jogged towards the shop. I jumped to my feet and started to run. With my left hand, I pulled my T-shirt up over my face, and so did she. We must have looked like a couple of sperm. I kept my eyes moving between the van and the shop. I didn't really bother about what Sarah was doing. The plan was for her to go to the near side of the van, to the passenger door. I was to go round the rear, because I wanted to hide myself as much as possible, then get in the driver's seat and go for it. The glass panels had been smashed out of the back doors and were covered with cardboard, and the whole thing was a rust bucket. I turned the corner of the van and moved along the side towards the driver's door. I had to skip over the loop of the pump lines and slipped on the diesel-stained floor. I recovered without falling and got to the door. Still holding the T-shirt over my head with my left hand, I got hold of the door handle in my right. It was a rickety, rusty old thing, hardly any chrome left on it. I pulled, and it all but came away in my hand, hanging on by one edge. The window on the other side was misted up, and I couldn't see what Sarah was doing. All I knew was that she wasn't getting in. She must have the same problem. Her handle must be busted. The driver's window was down about 3/4 of the way. That must be how he got in. Just reach in and open up from the inside. I jumped up slightly, got my right hand in, and then chaos. The furious barking from the back of the wagon made me jump back, as if I'd been given the full 20 seconds with a taser. I glanced towards the shop. The guy was staring out, mouth wide open. Someone trying to nick his van must have been the last thing he expected. The black thing in the back of the van was leaping up and down, going ballistic. I had to put my hand inside again. It had to be done. I was committed now. I reached in, yelling for Sarah to do something. I was jumping up and down, trying to find and grab the inside handle. The dog was reacting as if it had had to wait 3 days for lunch. And to the left of me, the distraught owner was coming out of the shop, shouting, "My dog! My dog!" "Sarah, fucking do something!" She did. I heard a loud, quick double tap from Lance's 9mm. It couldn't get worse than this. I jumped away from the window, leaving the dog in the van going apeshit, and ran round to the front of the vehicle. "Sarah, fucking stop shooting! Stop!" Then I realized she wasn't firing at the driver. She was drawing down on the two German shepherds that had come out of the tree line and were now about 5 meters away from giving us the good news. It had just got worse. She took one down. It fell over itself and kicked around on the ground, yelping. The other one kept coming. Sarah turned to fire, but it was too close to me now. My right hand flew down to draw my weapon at the same time as my left went to pull up my bomber jacket so that I could get to the pistol. It was too late for both of us. It's pointless trying to evade an attacking dog so close. Without a weapon, you can't do anything about immobilizing the fucker until it's committed itself to an attack. You've got to let the thing sink its teeth into you and take it from there. I had to get him onto me. I turned half left, let go of the bottom of my jacket and presented my forearm, still trying to get to my pistol with my right. He didn't want to miss this. He leapt up, his jaws opening with a deep growl. His lips pulled back to bare his teeth, so he got a good bite first time. I saw his eyes roll back as he launched himself at me. I stood my ground and braced myself for the hit. I felt his saliva fly onto my face as he opened up and his head flicked back. There were probably other things going on, but they were lost on me now. I couldn't hear anything but the snarling of my attacker. I felt the weight of the dog hit me, and then him closing his jaws on my arm. His teeth sank straight through the jacket into the skin of my forearm, and I started to shout,
"Sarah! Sarah!"
I wanted her to come and shoot this fucking thing.
"Sarah!"
I staggered backwards with his weight, and he came with me. I got my hand around the pistol grip, not completely, but enough to pull it out of my jeans. The dog was jumping up on me, trying to get me to the ground, his hind legs scrambling against my legs and waist. His legs hit my hand and the weapon fell.
"Sarah!"
There was fearsome pain as his teeth tore into my skin. It was like having multiple injections with pen-sized syringes. I had to let it happen. I had to make sure the dog had confidence in himself, that he sensed an easy victory. If I went with the flow, he'd keep his teeth in one place, thinking he had me. He wouldn't thrash around all over the place. Forget the old wives' tale about grabbing a foreleg in each hand and splitting them apart. It only works for chihuahuas, and that's assuming you can catch the little shit in the first place. In real life, dogs are like monkeys. They're much stronger than they look. I continued to move back under its weight as the German Shepherd jumped up and snarled. I could smell his raw, meat-eating breath mixed with mud and the shit on his coat from the follow-up. He took a deeper grip on my arm, and I screamed out for Sarah again as I felt more flesh being mangled. She was nowhere to be seen. I heard several gunshots as I staggered back towards the driver's side of the van. I was trying to look and act submissive. I didn't want to fight this fucking thing. I just wanted Sarah to come round and hose him down. The dog's handler and the police wouldn't be far behind. We needed to get moving. The animal's growl changed tone as he shook his head from side to side like a mad thing, trying to get a deeper grip. His rear legs were now on the floor, with his front pads on my chest, walking back with me like a circus performer, still attempting to join his jaws together, but through my arm. Now the black thing inside the van sparked up again as I heard more gunshots. But there was no instant, miraculous release of the grip on my arm. It wasn't going to happen. I'd have to do it on my own. The dog was feeling really confident now. He knew he'd got me. I bent down and, with my right hand, grabbed hold of his left rear leg. The limb twitched as if he was doing an Irish jig as he tried to kick away. I started to pull the back leg up towards me. The dog was confused and pissed off, biting more and moving his head from left to right. I was grappling to keep hold of his leg. It was darting away like Michael Flatley on speed. I got a firmer grip on the spindly bit at the bottom of the dog's leg and, with my right arm, pulled it up as hard as I could towards my chest, at the same time starting to turn. The dog yelped with surprise, and I started to pirouette, as if I was spinning a child in a game. I did 3, 4, 5 turns, and the dog started to rise with the centrifugal force, anchored by its teeth in my arm and my hand on his leg. He had to make a decision, and he did. He let go of my arm. I didn't reciprocate by letting go of the leg. I kept hold now with both hands and swung him round and round as violently as I could. Still spinning, I managed to take 2 steps towards one of the concrete pillars supporting the forecourt canopy. On the 3rd step, the dog's head connected with the pillar. There was a thud and a weak yelp, and I let go. My own momentum carried me on round for another 1.5 turns. My head was spinning as I tried to get my bearings. I found the van. Sarah was sitting in the cab, firing out of the window. I screamed at her,
"The door! The door!"
She leaned across and opened it up. I looked down. My pistol was by the pump line. Bending down to pick it up and keeping bent to avoid getting hit, I half-jumped, half-collapsed into the driver's seat and slammed the door closed. As I did, the black thing in the back tried to scramble over the driver's seat. Sarah shouted,
"Let's go! Come on, let's go!"
I was still in a semi-stoop over the steering wheel, trying to present a smaller target, when the police started firing back at us. All the windows were steamed up, probably from the dogs panting, which was good for us, because at least it hid us from the video. Just as well, as the T-shirt ploy had gone to ratchet the moment the dogs arrived on the scene. I hit the ignition, and the engine turned over, but it failed to engage. It sparked up on the second go. Sarah fired a few more rounds towards the tree line. The mutt behind me wasn't biting, but it was making more noise than the weapon reports. The shots that hit the van reminded me of being in a helicopter under fire, because it's so loud inside the aircraft. You don't know you're being attacked until you see holes suddenly appearing in the airframe, accompanied by a dull ping as the rounds penetrate. The driver was screaming his head off inside the shop, jumping up and down, but no way was he coming out until the shooting stopped. The woman was on the phone, shouting into the useless receiver, and as we rolled off the forecourt, the driver started running along inside the shop, keeping up with us, his arms waving in the air as he screamed at the top of his voice. It was wasted on us. He was inside the shop, and his fucking dog was making enough noise to drown the roar of a helicopter. Ping. Sarah was still screaming. Come on! Come on! Come on! And the dog was adding his tuppence worth. He wanted out. Didn't we all? I turned left onto the road. There was a coffee holder on the dash, with a half-full poly cup of coffee in it, with a cigarette butt floating on the top. As the van lurched, the whole lot went over my jeans. Then, surreally, the radio suddenly came on of its own accord. Sarah fired a few more rounds into the tree line. There was a return. I looked in the wing mirror. The police were on the road, assuming proper firing positions. I put my foot down. I jerked my thumb at the dog and shouted at Sarah, "Sort that fucking thing out!" I turned left again and started to drive up the hill. I looked behind me and saw this big, black, mangy thing. Fuck knows what it was, just a wet, dank dog in the back, jumping up at the newspaper Sarah was trying to hit and distract it with, barking and yelping away at us both. We started to take the right-hand bend in the road. The moment we were out of sight of the junction and shop, I hit the brakes. I yelled, "Get that fucking thing out!" "How? Just get it out!" She opened the door and tried to grab hold of the dog, but it was already scrabbling its way out, its claws tearing against her seat. It clambered over and fucked off. It probably hadn't been trying to have a go at us at all. It had just been frantic to get back to its owner. She closed the door and I hit the gas pedal. I'd noticed some bags and stuff in the back. "Why don't you check that out?" She didn't need telling again. She was straight in there. Chapter 22. Is there a map? My arm was killing me as I gripped the steering wheel. The wagon's heating system wasn't up to it, so I used my sleeve to wipe the condensation from the windscreen. Even the wipers only worked on half speed. At least now I could sort of see where I was going, even if I wasn't too sure where that was. The bend eventually straightened out, and trees loomed up on either side. Above them, all I could see was thick, grey cloud. Great. The worse the weather, the less the chance of the heli still operating. "Nothing, just crap." Sarah was back in her seat. She wound down the window and started to adjust the wing mirror to keep a check behind us. I kept my foot down, but the vehicle was only making about 60 miles per hour with the wind behind it. The threadbare tyres not exactly gripping the road big time. All the shit in the back was rattling, and bits of paper were flying around in the draft, rushing through the open windows. I just hoped the brake pads were in better shape than the bits of the wagon I could see. She tried to pull open the glove compartment on her side, which probably hadn't been done for years. It gave way and out spilled bits of fishing wire, lighters, greasy old garage receipts, all sorts. But no map. she shouted.
Shit, shit, shit!
I kept quiet, letting her frustration play itself out. I drove on for about 3 miles, during which we didn't say a word to each other. We got to a T-junction with the same sort of road. There were no signposts. I turned right. I was feeling exposed. I didn't know if the police back at the gas station had comms, which would depend on whether they had relay boards in the area to bounce radio signals off. I couldn't help a smile. Metal Mickey's head would have come in handy. I shouted at her so I could be heard above the noise of the wind. "Did you drop any of the police?" She was wiping the wing mirror. She seemed to have calmed down a bit.
"I don't know. I don't think so. Maybe."
I started to feel even more depressed. Whatever had happened, if we didn't get out of the area very soon and hide up, we'd be in a world of shit. Less than 2 minutes later, the chance came when I saw dipped headlights in front of us. "I'm going to take it, Sarah. Make sure you don't say a word, okay?" She nodded.
"What do I do?"
"Just point the gun at whoever's in there. Do not shoot anyone. Just keep your finger off the trigger, please." I slowed down to about 20 miles per hour and swung the van left, blocking the road. The car kept coming towards us. I couldn't see how many were in it, but it was a blue 4-door saloon. Sarah was waiting for instructions. "Come out this side and follow me. We have broken down, okay?" I jumped out, trying to watch the car as well as listen for a heli. The car slowed. It was a Mazda, one up, and going by the big hair blocking half the windscreen, she was the twin sister of the woman at the gas station. She wasn't too happy about what was going on. I had to be quick, in case she reached for a weapon. For all I knew, she might be one of Jim's best customers. The car stopped. I ran over to the driver's side with a very thankful face on. She hit her window button and let it down only a couple of inches, but at least she wasn't going for her handbag or the glove compartment. I got to the window and drew down on her, screaming, "Look down! Look down!" My accent was getting worse. She was maybe in her 30s. Her hair must have taken all day to tease into that beehive. Her makeup was about 2 millimeters thick and looked like wet cement now she'd started to cry. I yelled, "Out! Out!" The door was locked. I kicked it and made out like a madman, which wasn't far from the truth. She finally relented. Sarah heard the clunk of the central locking and started moving towards the car as the woman got out. I motioned with my hand for her to take the driver's seat. She passed the woman, who was standing on the road sobbing her heart out.
"I have babies. Please don't kill me. Please. Take the car, take the car. Take my money. Please don't kill me."
I wanted to tell her, "Shut up. You're not going to die. I'm playing the madman because I want to scare you. That way you don't go for a weapon and we all stay alive." Sarah was in. Door closed. I ran round to the other side and joined her. Before I'd even shut the door, she was slamming the car into a 3-point turn. I looked under my legs to see what I was sitting on. It was Big Hair's bag. No point in fucking her up completely. I got the barrel of the pistol hooked in the bag and threw it out to her, just as Sarah finished a really bad turn with lots of braking and tires screaming in the wet. "Get your foot down." She didn't need any prompting for that. The car interior smelled of fresh perfume and coffee. A large polystyrene cup with a lid was resting in the console holder. I lifted it out and gave it a shake. It was half full and the contents were still warm. I took a couple of sips and handed it over. The air conditioning was on. I turned a couple of dials and it soon changed to hot, hot, hot.
"Where to, Nick? Where am I going?"
I wasn't sure. "Just keep going until we see a sign." 10 minutes later, we hit a main drag and were welcomed to Route 98. Raleigh was to the left, Durham to the right.
Go left, left!
It was still a single carriageway, but wider than before and with houses dotted along the way. Before long, we were joining other vehicles on their daily migration towards the city, and in no time we were in mainstream traffic and had some cover. I said, "Have you got any rounds left?" She gave me her weapon. I checked and refilled her mag from the spares in my pockets and passed it back. She placed it under her right thigh with a, "Thanks." I started to recognize our surroundings. Traffic was starting to slow up. Every time we hit a major intersection, there was another bunch of lights, letting people out from all the suburbs around the city. We couldn't see any of the houses, though, because of the trees and low-level industrial units that hemmed us in on either side. We had stopped at a set of lights alongside some other people drinking their breakfast. Some of them had big paper cups from drive-ins. Some had mugs that looked like Apollo space capsules, really wide at the bottom so they didn't fall over in the car. Then narrow at the top with a nozzle to drink through. All of a sudden, I saw people in different cars around us smiling or laughing out loud to themselves. Sarah saw what was happening, and she wanted to listen in. She hit the radio buttons on preset and cruised through the stations. Three goes, and she got it. A man and a woman were talking about people's choices of bumper stickers. The woman said, "One is okay, but hey, more than that reads a 10 on my geek meter." The guy replied, "Have you seen the one that says, 'A mind is like a parachute? It only works when it's opened.' Come on, man, that's like off the scale." There was some canned laughter, then he quickly returned to the airwaves. "Hey, morning. It's Q98 coming at ya." The ads started to roll. Everyone was laughing with us in the traffic. Then it got worse as they saw the same thing we did. The van 4 or 5 vehicles ahead had that very sticker in its rear window. I couldn't stop laughing as we started to move on green. I looked over at Sarah, who was joining in the fun. It wasn't that the joke was that funny. I think we were just so relieved to be back in civilization. We hit the belt line, saw signs for the airport, and swung right at the intersection onto the highway. About halfway round, we were on an elevated section, and down below us were low-level square buildings, mostly motels and burger joints, islands in a sea of neon. The rain had slackened to a drizzle. I directed Sarah off the ramp, and we cruised around looking for a motel that would work for us. She drove past a Days Inn, standing in its own lot. It was a T-shaped building, with the reception at the top and 3 stories of brown doors making up the stem. It had seen better days, but was just what was needed. I let Sarah carry on past it so I could check out the area. That way, I knew which way to run if we got bumped once we were inside. "Turn left here." She drove into the parking lot of an adjacent single-story sportswear outlet. There were about 200 cars in the 400-capacity car park. She found a space in the middle and parked. We wiped the car interior of our prints, got out, and did the same to the outside. Not that it mattered that much, as they would have our prints from the van. It would just slow them up a bit. Walking back towards the motel, we made an effort to clean ourselves up, brushing the mud and pine needles off our clothes. It didn't seem to make much difference. We got a few strange looks in the car park, but nothing too serious. Americans know better than to stare at disheveled strangers. The motorway roared above us with the morning's traffic, and a truck's brakes hissed loudly as it stopped to make a delivery. As I peeled the gloves and cling film from the docks, I gave Sarah our story. "Okay, we're Brits. Boyfriend, girlfriend. Travelling up from the Cape Fear coast, had a puncture. We've been out in the rain trying to fix it, and all we want to do now is sort our shit out. She thought for a few seconds.
Got it.
I cleaned up the jacket sleeve the dog had ripped as best I could, wiping the dried blood on my hand against my jeans. A last quick spit and rub on the more stubborn stains did the trick. We'd put our hands through our hair in a last-minute effort to sort ourselves out as we went through the door. We still looked rough, but so did the motel. The carpet in reception needed replacing, and a new coat of paint wouldn't have gone amiss. To my left, a TV blared by the coffee and vending machines as the glass doors closed behind us. The receptionist went through the automatic company welcome.
Hi, how are you today?
Still looking down at something more important. She was about 17 or 18 and wore a maroon polyester waistcoat and skirt with a white blouse. Her name tag said she was Donna. She was a black girl with relaxed hair put into a side parting, a big, round pair of glasses and, now that she was actually pointing at us, a great big, brilliant smile. It might not be sincere, but at least she was the first person we'd been close to for a while who wasn't shooting at us. Her smile evaporated as she took in our appearance.
What's happened to you folks?
I did my best stupid English tourist impression.
We had a puncture this morning, and the car went off the road in all this rain. Look at us. It's been a nightmare. We just want to clean up and sleep.
I stopped my waffle and looked sorry for myself while showing her the state of my jeans. She agreed. We were in shit state.
Wow.
She looked down at the computer and hit the keys.
Let me see.
She didn't sound too hopeful.
It's early, and I don't know if any rooms will be ready yet.
She smiled as she read the screen, and I knew we were in luck.
Hey, you know what? I have a double room, but it's smoking.
The way she said it, I knew that when the time came for her to have a child, she'd sue someone lighting up even two states away. She looked up, waiting for us to share her distaste. I said,
"That will be fine, thank you."
She looked at us as if we were somewhere below subhuman.
"We don't smoke, but at the moment anything will do."
I smiled. We became normal again and were given a big smile back. She continued to hit the keys.
"Sure. I have a special at the moment. $39.99 plus tax."
Her expression now said that I should be jumping up and down with joy. I took the hint.
"That's great."
I pulled out my wallet and gave her my credit card. She could have been asking for $139.99 plus tax. I wouldn't have given a shit.
"Thank you."
She studied the card.
"Mr. Snell?"
She swiped the plastic and the machine clicked and hummed as I filled in the registration form. I put down any shit I could think of for the vehicle registration. They never look at it anyway, and if she did, I'd just say, "Sorry." Hugh Grant type character Brit abroad.
"Okay. Your room 216. Where are you parked?"
I pointed out and to the left. She started to direct with her hands.
"Okay, go round back to the left, up the first flight of stairs, and it's there on the right-hand side."
"Thanks a lot."
"You're welcome. Y'all have a good one."
We walked out of reception and I placed my arm around Sarah, talking shit about what a night it had been. We turned left to go to our non-car and worked our way round the motel to our room. There was a chance that anyone putting two and two together after watching the news might call the police, especially if the gas station was already news. But this girl looked as if she didn't even know what day it was. There had to be a point where I had to accept I'd done all I could for now. It was time to clean up, get our act together, and then move on. It was a typical low-rent motel room that could have been anywhere in the world, with a queen-sized bed, faded flower-pattern cover and white, melamine-veneered chipboard furniture.